Booktopia is coming back. The two-day-long event will be held at the North Shore Bookstore on Friday and Saturday, May 5th and May 6th. It will bring together a group of authors and readers to discuss books and share their mutual joy of novels and fiction writing across a series of events at the bookstore in Manchester and across the street at the First Baptist Church. Booktopia started as an event in collaboration with Books on the Nightstand, a podcast hosted by Anne Kingman and Michael Kindness, both sales representatives for Random House Publishers. Now it continues on at the North Shore Bookstore with exclusive author events, presentations, book signings, meet and greets, and a celebrity dinner. All told, 9 writers will be on hand to discuss their books, some of them very recently published. Davith Wood, the events manager at the North Shore, gave us the overview on what will be happening.
But the Friday morning starts, and the first thing, besides a welcome from Nicole Ihaz, one of our new owners, is a wonderful part. That's one of my favorite things to do, and a lot of the booksellers here too, and then the audience members love it, is what we call this gift card is burning a hole in my pocket, in which booksellers recommend some of their favorite recent titles. So I'll be recommending a few of those. The master bookseller Alden will be, Kathy Taylor, Rachel Persa, my colleague from Saratoga Springs, will recommend a few children's titles, some author titles, and also our floor manager, James, will be presenting those books. Then there's a little break for lunch, and then we move into the sort of the more formal author panels. And each author that we have 8 of these authors coming, they all present their new book twice. Solo presentations that's run throughout the day on Friday and then continue on through Saturday. Friday night is a big celebratory dinner at the Inn at Manchester's event barn. Amy Chamberlain will be catering that. It will be lovely. We've been working on the menu this morning. And then there's also Stephen Kiernan will be hosting a trivia contest that night at the dinner with some book questions, and there'll be little prizes for the winners. And then on Saturday, we've got another rack of events, sort of those solo author events. So there's that, and then it all concludes at the big event on Saturday night, which has always been free and open to the public, so no need to register for that, but that's going to be at 6 o'clock on Saturday night, and all of the 8 authors will present for about 10 minutes, talk about their books, about book selling, book reading, bookstores, banned books, those kind of things. Followed by a group signing in which all of the authors are present, signing copies of their books, and then that's it for Booktopia. The thing is about Booktopia is just it's a really sort of special event, hosting author events all the time. You can really see it. The electricity that comes in as they sort of descend on Manchester the Thursday night before Booktopia, it just sort of swells the store with this feeling of real joy and love for books. And they are the most passionate readers that I think I've ever met. Huge book lovers, huge book fans, and we call it a weekend where authors and readers meet. And that's really the case here. One element that is another special thing about Booktopia is that the attendees usually have bought and read all of the books that the authors have written before the event. So it really makes for special Q&As, and they have a real nice connection with the authors. The authors love it too, because it's really great for their promotion, for their publicity, and then they have these really wonderful conversations and are really thoughtful with the attendees. And I know from having hosted it in the past that a lot of the authors are sort of know about Booktopia already and feel really delighted to get to be a part of it.
There will be a few Vermont-based writers in the mix with new books coming out as well. One of them is Stephen Kiernan, from Charlotte, Vermont, and a former journalist with the Burlington Free Press. He spoke about his new book, titled The Glass Chateau.
Here's the thing. The people who come to Booktopia are a different kind of reader than I encounter generally. I'll give you an example. The first, typically if you have you do an event about a novel you've written and you take questions from the audience and somebody will say, where do you get your ideas? Well, that's a very nice question. I'm happy to speak about the rather silly and kind of idiosyncratic way that I get ideas. But the first question I took at the first Booktopia I went to the questioner said, you know, I've just read your previous novel and that came out in, 2015. And the main character is a hospice nurse. And I know that you published a nonfiction book in 2006 about hospice. And I'm wondering how your ideas of human mortality have evolved in those intervening 9 years. Like, it's a very, very different kind of atmosphere. And that makes it really, really fun. Yes. Yes, I have a novel, The Glass Chateau, that's coming out on June 19th, and I very much wanted to be able to provide them kind of in advance, but it's too far in advance. The books won't be printed and ready, but I do hope to talk about that. Right, every book has its challenge. In this one, it was the first draft wrote itself. It was a breeze, and then I sat down to really make sense of it, and it was an enormous revision effort to get it coherent and short. It was very casual and being very long. And so I needed to really take a lot out. And I actually spent more time rewriting the book than I did writing the first draft. That was the particular challenge of this book. Each one brings something new to the table, because I like to think anyway that each book you reach a little further. You test your imagination, you test your narrative capacity and your ability to create a scene and to have characters that feel like real people in the reader's imagination. And so you push a little more each time. And I think if there wasn't a challenge, it wouldn't work for me. The challenge is part of the fun of it.
Then we had a chance to chat with Sarah Strohmeyer, who, when she's not writing novels, and she has had several published, serves as the town clerk of Middlesex, Vermont. She discussed her soon-to-be-released new novel, We Love to Entertain.
We Love to Entertain. It's coming out from HarperCollins next Tuesday, the 25th. So the timing is great. And it's the first book out of the 20 I've written that's set in Vermont. So the book I wrote last, my most recent thriller, was called Do I Know You, which was set on Cape Cod, about a super recognizer. And this is about a celebrity rehab couple who steal a prime piece of real estate out from under a Vermonter and go missing. So it's actually, for me, it's very timely. I don't know how people who are not into property tax sales might go, you know, I had to redline out a whole bunch of stuff about property tax sales because I find them interesting, but I'm not sure that our reader does. But it's twisty and it's fun. And there's a lot of high-end rehab references, you know, home rehab, which I really like because I'm an HGTV fan. But also as a town clerk, I've seen people come here, and I'm sure you have where you are, just snap up properties left, right, and center during the pandemic for sometimes double what they're appraised at. And now we've got this high-end, we've got, you know, people from all over the place living in big high-end homes. And, you know, there are clashes. So it's pretty, I feel like it's timely, and I wove in some of my town clerk experience. So that's been kind of fun. And yeah, it's just been it was a fun book to write, and I hope it's a fun book to read. You know, that's the great thing about this career choice is I've made the best friends by being an author, really great lifelong friends. Even if we don't see each other for, you know, months or even years, you're just great friends. It's a great community to be part of. And whenever you go to a conference like this, like Booktopia, as a reader, you're going to be inspired by all these great books and to read, and it's going to be a lot of fun. You know, it seems like a really fun event. But also as an author, you're inspired by your fellow authors. And it's rejuvenating. I'm really looking forward to it. It's going to be the second conference I'm going to in about 2 weeks' time. And I know by the end, I'm going to walk away with a lot of book recommendations and a great, you know, TBR pile. So it's going to be, I'm going to try to make it as the most fun for those in attendance as possible. That's my job there.
Booktopia returned last year after a pandemic-induced two-year hiatus. And for readers, book lovers, authors, and those who want to be authors, this will be one to mark on the calendar. For more information, visit the Northshire Bookstore's website at northshire.com/events. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. Locally grown food has long been available through farmers markets, and in Vermont, homegrown produce has made its contribution to building the Vermont brand. During the COVID pandemic, some of the small local farms struggled to get their produce to market, and outlets like North Shore Grown Direct stepped in to help. Now, farmers, food producers, sellers, and those in between are coming together to build on that in hopes of establishing a food hub that will provide markets for local farmers and consumers. A forum held recently on the Hill Farm Inn in Sunderland, which followed an earlier one held at the Manchester Community Library, and will be followed in turn by a third one in Bennington later in May, are bringing together the players who may play a role in that effort. One of the organizers of the farm forum at the Hill Farm Inn was Liz Ruffa, the Advancement Director at Merck Forest and Farmland Center, who was also instrumental in getting North Shore Grown Direct going back in 2020. She described what was underway today.
There's been a very exciting development for Bennington County, which is that a group of folks that had been being convened through Bennington College's CAPA program was working on, during COVID, there was a group of people that got together as a working group just to think about, what are we doing? You know, what is missing with local agriculture in this area? What could we do better to be serving our farms and growers better? What could we be doing better to get schools more involved in local purchasing, hospitals and healthcare organizations and all the rest? And so there was an opportunity to apply for a congressionally designated spending grant to think about the Bennington County food system. And a group of folks got together and put together a compelling case study for something called the Bennington Fair Food Initiative, which really was a comprehensive capacity building effort to really grow, not only grow the Bennington County network, but also to align it with statewide and even regional New England efforts. And so an application was put in. It was advanced by then Congressman Peter Welch, and an award was made last December to the town of Bennington to advance this idea of growing a Bennington Fair Food Initiative. So it's very, very exciting. It's the funding will go to support growing a network that will have a number of different local partners, many of them workforce development engines. Southwest Tech is a part of it. The Vermont Veterans Home is a part of it. Certainly Bennington College and the town of Bennington. And there's a space that's been identified. It's adjacent to the wonderful new Bennington Community Market right in downtown Bennington at 239 Main Street. And so some of the work that we're doing with these forums up at Merck Forest will hopefully inform how that space is organized and built out to be a comprehensive farmer and food producer service center. It could be a laboratory. It could be a culinary incubator space. It could be a lot of things. And so that's what folks are starting to look into, figuring out what's going to make the most sense and how to build it out so that it is not only a really great addendum to the market and is aligned with the market, but that it's also really serving farmers in the area that are looking for different ways to improve their bottom lines. And for that matter, farms in the Saratoga area, farms in, you know, the Berkshires, farms in Rutland. You know, we all know as Vermonters that no one's worthy if they don't put at least a couple of hours worth of driving into something from time to time. So that's what we're doing with this discovery now, is really finding out what the needs are and seeing how we can meet them. So, you know, a lot more to come on that, but it is it's a very, very exciting development.
Another organizer of the Farm Food Initiative is Shannon Barsotti, the Community Development Director in Bennington.
But we really want it to be a center that's focused on farmers and food producers. So that can mean, actual space to aggregate and store products, whether that's cold storage, dry storage, etc. Commercial kitchens that could be available for use for processing or renting. event space given its location, because it is, I hear this a lot, people are looking for pop-up spaces. So we have all of these great chefs, but you know, who can afford a brick and mortar space for a restaurant? So I think we really have a lot of different options and people who we can serve in Bennington County, and that's what we want to do, and use the space also to bring in all the other resources around economic development, business consulting, you know, whether that's through UVM Extension or the Small Business Administration. There are some really good programs out there, but I mean, it's such a web of navigating where they all are and who you contact, and if we can streamline that and really have a spot where people know to go for resources, I think that's going to have a big impact on our food system and really helping to grow our local food business.
The Food Initiative has been boosted by a federal grant of more than $2 million for the project, and Senator Peter Welch played a role in pushing that across the finish line. We had a chance to talk with him about it during another interview.
It was very exciting to me to see folks getting a really good plan together that is going to have environmental, nutrition, economic benefits to the Bennington region. I was very excited to be supportive.
Farmers markets aren't going anywhere, but some new food options may be emerging soon. For the GNET TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. A good school bus driver is not always easy to find. The hours are a little unusual, 6 to 8 in the morning, then back for a couple of hours in the afternoon. You'll need a commercial driver's license, and it helps if you enjoy hanging out with the kids. The Bennington-Rutland Supervisory Union has 32 bus routes across its sprawling territory that covers 6 elementary and middle schools from Sunderland to Danby and from Manchester to Londonderry, and all have regular drivers, for now. But finding the right people, who can manage the hours and are responsible, safe drivers, is not an automatic thing. Derek Chalmers, the Supervisory Union's Director of Transportation, is also one of the backup bus drivers, and he described the view from the driver's seat for us.
How hard is it to find bus drivers these days? Is it still as difficult as it was a year or two ago?
Yes, it is.
And why do you think that's so?
I think a lot of it is it's a split shift. You got to run in the morning, run in the afternoon. It's not a full-time year-round job. It's a part-time school year position.
So someone would work like what, from 6 to 9 in the morning?
6 to 8, and then most runs, not all the runs. My big bus drivers work about 6 to 8, and then they come back in at 2 to 4. So about 4 hours a day.
So if someone has another job, they have to fit in around those hours, I guess.
Yeah.
So what are some of the requirements you have for your drivers? They have to have a commercial driver's license.
A Class B with a school bus and passenger endorsement.
And how complicated is it to get a commercial driver's license if you don't already have one? Is it long, several months of work or whatever? What's involved with it?
Yeah, it takes on average 3 months to get it, depending on how you do with your test taking. As long as you study, it's usually about 3 months.
So does the testing involve doing a lot of driving around of school buses or trucks, and an instructor grades you on how well you're doing, or how does that all work?
Yeah, you need a certain number of hours behind the wheel and a certain number of hours in the classroom, what we call classroom time. I have a bus driver in-house that we do our own training here, put you through it. And there's some fees, and we cover the fees too after you get your license. We reimburse you just to try to get drivers.
So there's written test, classroom work, and actual behind the wheel time.
Yep.
Okay. So what would you say is the hardest part of the job?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I used to drive around every day. Now I'm a sub. So for me, it was other drivers, right? Oncoming traffic. The kids for me were pretty well behaved. But you're trying to manage the kids, the traffic. People don't really follow the rules. The red lights to some people don't mean anything. So that was the major thing I saw on the road.
One of the BRSU's bus drivers is Sue Miller, who handles a route in Dorset. She enjoys the job, she said, a lot.
I had a friend that used to live in Middletown Springs, and he still drives school bus, and he told me I'd be good at it, so I figured I'd try it, and I like it, and I love it, and I love the kids.
Was it hard getting through the CDL, or is that not a big deal?
No, not at all. I drive big rigs anyway, so that wasn't a problem for me. And I also worked on my own vehicle, so I knew the operation of the large vehicle. It was just a matter of learning on how to use the systems on the bus, and that wasn't a problem. When people ask me what I do, I tell them that I haul precious cargo to and from safely. My job is to make sure that they get to and from safely. The frustration for me is when I am stopping and I'm putting my yellow lights on, warning other drivers that I am going to be stopping very soon, and they speed up. That is the worst part of the job, because that is just a horror show to me. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that, but it's scary, because I cannot release those children off the bus until I know perfectly well all traffic is stopped and they can cross safely. When they are on the bus, they are my children. They are my children, and they're my responsibility.
So what's the most fun part of it? Hanging out with the kids?
Yes, it is. And you know what? I am a grandmother, and I love kids, and I've always have. I like when they start at the beginning of the school year, and they're little, and they're new. And then as the year progresses, even over vacation, they grow. They grow, they change. And they grow up until they're finally going up to high school, and a couple years later, you'll be in the store and they're a cashier, or they're working for their dad or something like that. But to know that you were there to see that progression of them grow.
We continued the conversation with Sue on board her school bus.
So the kids don't scream and yell a lot or whatever, or I guess they're all plugged into their headphones and cell phones and stuff.
Some days. If it's a half day, it's really difficult because they didn't get the burn off that afternoon energy and they're a little louder. Or if some special thing went on at school, they're loud. It's interesting. It's the buzz of the bus. Like if it's a vacation and they're going to have off the next week or something, they're all...
Do you often have a full bus?
Anywhere between 36 and 41, maybe, depending on if there's kids that need to be transferred over to the rec park for soccer or for softball. They'll hitch a ride with me, because when I leave Dorset, I go to MEMS to drop some kids off to catch the Sunderland bus, so they'll ride also.
What happens if something goes wrong with the bus mechanically? Do you have to call? I guess you have a setup where you can call and get the tow truck or whatever? Or has that ever happened?
To me personally, no. No, but there is protocols for it, just like we do fire drills twice a year. We do it in the fall and in the spring. If there was something mechanically wrong with the bus, I would have to pull over to a safe spot if possible. Call on my radio that I have here to the office and let them know what's going on and if there's children on the bus or not. And for me, I enjoy the kids. I love the kids. I don't get to see my grandkids all the time, so for me to have kids every day on the bus, it's awesome.
The BRSU is always on the lookout for new drivers, so if the hours work and if you either already have or are prepared to get the CDL or commercial driver's license, the BRSU wants to meet you.
If somebody was interested in becoming a bus driver, what should they reach out to you?
Yeah, they should call me immediately. We're always looking. It's always good to get a sub lined up, and usually I can find them a 4 or 5 hour a day job. once they get their CDL. It's hard for me to make promises. Things change all the time. I lose routes because of certain kids and on the special ed side of things. But and if you have a Class A without your school bus endorsement, we're interested in that too. We have to go through the most of the same stuff if you didn't have one at all, but except for if you wouldn't have to take two tests, general knowledge and air brakes. But
to qualify for a CDL in Vermont, you must be at least 18 years old, have a valid Vermont driver's license, pass a drug test, and obtain a medical certificate. And if you're a bit of a morning person, that's probably good too. For the GNET TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. An extension to an existing sewer line which will run up Manchester's Main Street from Cemetery Avenue to the mobile home park next to the town hall got a green light at the town select board meeting on Tuesday, April 25th. The select board awarded the contract for the project to SUR Construction West, a construction firm based in Winchester, New Hampshire, for a little over $2.85 million. It was the lower of two bids received. The other one checked in at about $3.083 million. The select board meeting, held at the Manchester Community Library, where it was initially going to be a brief meeting before a joint meeting with the Manchester Planning Commission to discuss a controversial cell tower proposal, wound up running more than an hour as select board members, town manager Scott Murphy, and contract engineer Chrissy Haskins of the Dufresne Group, who was calling in remotely, discussed connection fees and assessments. In the end, the select board opted to have the connection fees for the new sewer extension remain the same as those for other ratepayers in other sewer districts around the town, about 60 cents per $100 of assessed property value instead of $1 per $100 of assessed property value.
It's a new district. We can do whatever we want with it, but it would be nice to have some consistency throughout the system.
The difference mattered because of how the town will eventually pay for the sewer project. Plans call for it to be funded by up to $1.9 million in town meeting-approved borrowing and a little more than $600,000 in federal grant money, along with the connection fees paid by users in the district. Meanwhile, the planned joint meeting with the Planning Commission has been rescheduled until Tuesday, May 2nd, and will be held at the library's Hunter Room as originally planned, starting at 6 p.m. On the sewer project, we spoke with Town Manager Murphy afterwards to get the big picture of the infrastructure project, which has seen its share of ups and downs over the past couple of years as funding sources didn't measure up to the cost estimates.
They wanted us to get this done, the contract awarded, as quickly as possible, and that's why we held that special meeting last night. So they're anxious to get going. Now, the key part of that discussion last night, which really didn't get talked about too much, I think, is that of that $2.853,856 contract, we're going to ask SUR Corporation West to take out the private development section of that. And that will reduce our actual contract with them. I mean, we'll have a contract amount at the 2.8 level, but our first change order will reduce that private investment section. So we will end up with 2.5 and change contract, 2.54 approximately, actual work construction contract. And so that leaves us with the reliance on the connection fees, which they approved last night, you saw, and then anything different, any difference would have to come out of the capital reserve. Our hope is that there'd be very minimal drawdown on the capital reserve side, which would be reimbursed as we received the connection fees.
The sewer line project has often been cited as critical to helping spur more badly needed housing development. One new project is already underway, but more might be in the offing, including a proposed hotel and spa on a site across Route 7A from the town hall. Construction of the new sewer line is expected to begin shortly, Town Manager Murphy said, and he hopes it will be finished by the end of this year. People living along the route of the new sewer line aren't required to connect to it and can opt out, but they would still have to pay an assessment fee. A third phase of the Sewer Line extension, running up to the intersection with North Road, may be next. For the GNET TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.